So thanks very much for the invitation. It's awesome to be here. So this is work done with Daniel Agana, who is a postdoc at Stony Brook, and with Josh Riedemann, who's at NYU. And what we did was we took a look at some of the LEP bounds for charged particles and looked at them a little more carefully and quantitatively. So let me start off by saying, by light here, I mean light from the collider sense, so like tens of GeV to maybe 100 GeV. I realize light in different contexts may mean different things, especially around these parts, perhaps. Okay, so let's start off with a LEP quiz. So these are some statements that came as a result of the LEP program, and let's sort of look at them, which ones we think are true. So A, LEP says that weakly charged particles have masses less than half, should have masses greater than half the Z mass. LEP says that electrically charged particles should have masses greater than 94 GeV. And LEP says that the number of neutrinos that couple to the Z is 3. And then, of course, there's the various combinations. So A and B, B and C, A and C, A, B and C, and not A, B, not A, not B, and not C. Okay, so let's look at these a little more carefully. So I think the takeaway usually is that you would say that these are all sort of robust statements that were made as a result of LEP's results. But let's look at them slightly more carefully. So weakly charged particles, so the measurement of the Z width is measured to 1 part per mil. Which means that if you want to contribute, if you want to have a new particle that the Z could decay to, has to contribute to the width at less than 0.1%. That's quite small because all the other particles that the Z decays to are basically in the percent to 10% range. So that's a fairly robust statement. That's one that's hard to get around. The number of neutrinos from LEP. So what they did here is on the x-axis here is a scan over the center of mass energy of the collisions. This is just the overall cross section, and this depends on the total width. So here you can calculate what the total width is according to the number of neutrinos that you put in. So you put in the standard model values, and then you float the number of neutrinos that you have. And you can see here that number of 3 fits very well to the data, and 2 and 4 are clearly not what's describing the data. So that's a fairly robust statement. Where does the electrically charged particle number come from? So if I just open up the PDG, then they'll tell me that there's 94 GeV bound on charged genos. Given some mass splitting, which I'll talk a little bit more about in the talk. But given that this is bound on charged genos, why am I extending this to charged particles in general and making sort of a more general statement? So the idea behind this is that if you look at how charged genos are produced at LEP, you have a contribution from S-channel photons and then S-channel Z. So the S-channel photon contribution is just E plus E minus annihilating through a photon and then to some charged particle, let me just call it F. The cross-section with just including the photon contribution is basically the first thing that you calculate in field theory. So you get something that goes like the coupling, the alpha squared, and then depending on the charge of this final state particle. And likewise, if we take the Z contribution in isolation, of course there's interference, but the interference is small. The Z contribution in isolation away from the pole gives you a similar contribution where there's charges are basically, you replace the charge by this effective coupling to the Z. So for electrons and positrons, this gives you this factor here. And then this charge will depend on the charge. And then the weak isospin numbers of the weak numbers of the particle here. So if the bound is going to apply, so this is going to give you some minimum cross section. If this is already ruled out, then you can safely say that anything else is just going to add positively, so that any other charged particle will be ruled out. So that's sort of the gist of why we call this a robust bound from LEP. In fact, experiments often consider this so robust that they don't even plot below this. So for example, here's a plot from Atlas from a disappearing track search. Here, you can sort of see it, that there's a teal band here, where in fact, it's almost a little bit sad because they could have continued here. You can even see that because of the way they plotted it, the yellow's peeking out behind it, but they just cover it with the teal band. They don't show below it. Similarly, here's another Atlas search for some decays involving leptons and neutrinos. And here they cut it off at 103.5 GeV, and they just don't plot below here. So in fact, what I'll show you in this talk is that this bound is actually not as robust as you think it is. And basically, I'm going to try to make this a quantitative statement to say exactly what I mean by that. OK, so the outline of this talk will be, let me motivate why you might care about having light charged particles, why you might care about this bound at all. Then I'll go back, look at some of the LEP searches, talk about them in a little more detail. Then I'll talk about exactly what needs to happen in your model in order to have light charged particles that go below these naive LEP bounds. Then I'll discuss what LHC says about these limits, that in some cases they actually can close some of these windows, but that they're still actually some windows open after LHC bounds are taken into account, and then I'll conclude. Okay, so why do we care about light charged particles? Let me start from maybe the most European to the least European reasons. So one is, this is just important to be precise. We're running, you know, collider experiments. It's good to know exactly the number. If we're going to be setting bounds on particles, we should know what the bound is. In particular, I mean, we're talking about charged particles here. Charged particles are fairly ubiquitous. It's easy to imagine that if you have some new particle appearing in some model, that it could be charged. That's highly plausible. Next, the LHC triggers are rising. So as we go to higher and higher energies and luminosities, the LHC triggers typically go up, so they increase to higher and higher PTs for the leptons and for the jets. For the standard signals at LHC, this isn't a problem because you're looking for very high energy stuff. But when you're talking about light stuff, so for example, here we're talking in the hundreds of 100 GeV and below range, then you might start to worry that if the triggers get high enough, then you start to not see these signals and you're cutting out what you could have been looking for here. So if there is light stuff to look for, we should know about this. You may view it as a model building tool. Perhaps you have some model that would that uses a light charged particle in the spectrum to generate some anomalies elsewhere, somewhere else. And finally, light chargenos are possible. So if you're a proponent of natural SUSY, where you want light Higgsinos, then it's very useful to know exactly how light these chargenos could actually be. Okay, so a review of LEP for some people who are maybe less familiar. So LEP2 ran for about 5 years, from 95 to 2000. It ran at a variety of center mass energies, basically ranging from 130 GeV up to about 208 GeV, where the bulk of its data was collected sort of at the higher end. There were four detectors there, Aleph, Delphi, L3, and Opal. And each detector collected approximately 700 inverse picobarn. So that collectively they have about 3 inverse picobarn total. This is about an order of magnitude down from what the LHC collects. And here you can see that they didn't always run at the same energy. They sort of jumped around energies, and they collected various amounts of data at each energy they ran at. Okay, so this is the bound that LEP tells us on chargenos. So this is the one I showed before, 94, assuming that some splitting is large enough. And then the PDG also quotes a larger bound of 500 GeV, which is coming from LHC searches, which look for hard leptons and missing energy. So let's not talk about this one for now. This is from the LHC, but let's talk about these LEP ones. The other source you might look for in terms of finding the correct chargeno bound is there's a variety of combinations from LEP results where they had working groups that combined the four experiments together. So there's this is from the SUSY working group, and they combined the results from all four experiments, and they gave him with this bound here, so 103.5 GeV. And this is the number that you saw in one of these ATLAS plots where they cut off that red line on the searches. So one of these numbers, let's figure out which one of these numbers is the bound that we should be taking. Okay, so reviewing how chargenos are produced at LEP. So as we said, they just have this annihilation E plus E minus through a gamma or a Z into chargenos. The production rate, so just including the photon contribution, is roughly 2 picobarn. And then there's some contribution from the Z, which depends on which particle you're talking about. So Higgsinos, which are doublets, will contribute, have only a small contribution from the Z, so they contribute a little bit less, they have a little bit less than 3 picobarn. Winos, on the other hand, are triplets, so they have larger isospin numbers, and then they have roughly 6.5 picobarn, so these are larger. But these are sort of the numbers when we're looking at limits. What you should be keeping your head is sort of on the ballpark of 3 picobarn, somewhere in here. So far, the formulas I gave you before are basically in the massless limit, but of course there's mass effects, so as the masses will approach the half, as you have enough mass to exactly equal the center of mass energy, you just won't produce them, there's not enough energy. And then as you scale down from that appropriately, the cross-sections are reduced. So for example, this is what the photon cross-section would look like, restoring all the mass dependence. And then plotting here, so this is the ratio of including the mass dependence and excluding the mass dependence. So as I eventually go to small masses, this will get to 1. But as you get to higher and higher masses, approaching half the center of mass energy, it's going to drop essentially to 0. So this is a log plot, so you can see that already about 90-ish, 95, 96, you're at about half of the cross-section that you would have had. And then when you get to here, so if you have your cross-section is about 10%, so still order 1, but it's substantially away from what the cross-section would have been in the massless limit. And that's basically right at half the center mass energy of your collisions. And this sort of goes along with the the rule of thumb that you have for lepton colliders. So whenever you do projections for lepton colliders, the asymptotic limit is essentially half the center of mass energy. So for example, at a 1 TeV lepton collider in the asymptotic limit, you'd say that my limits on things would be 500 GeV because you just have to pair produce them. This, of course, assumes that your systematics are small, and this assumes that you have enough luminosity that you've essentially covered as far as, so you overcome any suppression you get from the fact that your mass is starting to approach the limit. Okay, then we have to talk about the decay modes of the particles. So here at Chargino, when you have a large splitting, meaning the splitting between the charged state and the neutral state, when it's large enough to allow for W, this is what happens. It just decays to W. So this is a 2-by decay, and the W will in turn decay to jets or leptons with some branching ratio. As your splitting starts to get smaller, so as this gets small enough that it doesn't allow an on-shell W, it'll decay through an off-shell W. So now this is a 3-by decay, and it'll go to leptons again or to quarks. And eventually, when your splitting gets small enough, there's still leptonic decays, but the hadronic decays will instead go directly to pions. So this becomes a 2-by decay again instead of the 3-by decay. Looking at branching ratios, this sort of does what you expect it to do. So in the range up here, where the splitting is larger, this follows the ratio just from the W splitting. As you start to decrease the mass splitting, so you're starting to compress the decays, then what happens is the heavier particle gets heavy particles get squeezed out. So for example, the tau, you stop being able to make that. Eventually, you stop being able to decay to the charms. And that increases the light leptons, so electrons and muons. And as well, it starts to increase the quarks. Then eventually, the pions become two-bodies, so the pions start to increase much faster. And you have a pion rate that dominates. And eventually, once you get below the pion threshold, you can't make pions anymore. And you basically always make electrons. And that's when this red here peeking out over here. So the mass splitting in slightly more detail. So the splitting, what I've been calling here, is the difference between the charged and the neutralino. Let me just call it delta M from here on. As I mentioned on the last page, it determines the branching ratios in the limit where it's small. In the limit where it's large, it's just the W branching ratios. What it also does is it sets the energy of the daughters. So the way that you can see this is if you consider a 2-by decay. So now chargino going neutralino plus pion. This is the momentum that the pion has in the center of mass frame of the chargino. It's given by some combination of the masses. The fact that I can take the expansion on the fact that the pion mass is small compared to the neutralino and the chargino mass. So expanding this way, I get this simplified formula where it's just a ratio squared of chargino to neutralino over the chargino mass. And then also in the limit where the chargino mass is similar to the neutralino mass, meaning that the splitting is small, this just reduces the splitting. So this tells you sort of the fact that you already guessed probably that the momentum that the pion has goes like the mass splitting. This is in the 2-body case. So you can imagine in the cases where you have 3-body decays, as I mentioned, that happens fairly frequently when you go to leptons. In the 3-body decay, you're shared between three particles now. The decay daughters have even less energy. So delta M is sort of setting how much energy, the upper range of how much energy your decay products can have. That's important because it determines what searches are viable to look for these particles. So basically, the searches, it's easier to think about them if you divide them by regions of splitting. So for large splittings, I call it the bulk region. There you look for the sort of the standard Suzy signals of leptons, jets, missing energy, just hard stuff that you can trigger off of and look for. Once the splitting starts to get smaller, so sort of less than 3 GeV, but larger than sort of 300 MeV, this is the compressed region where the decay products are now soft enough that it's harder to trigger on them. So then you benefit from having something else in the event. So in this case, you look for an initially radiated photon, which helps in two ways. One is the photon is hard, so you can trigger off the photon. The second is that the photon now recoils off the system, which means that what was originally soft gets a little bit harder. So your leptons that might have only had splittings of maybe 3 GeV of energy get boosted above that because of recoiling off the photon, so they're easier to look for as well. So these are ISR-assisted searches. Then as you start to get smaller and smaller, the lifetime starts to get longer, and you start to get into this displaced region where the lifetime is now in the order of centimeters to meters. Here you start to look for more impact parameter-based searches. You look for kinks. So kinks meaning that you have a chargino that goes for some distance, and then it will decay to a charged pion or something else, which will go off in some other direction, and then the neutral part, which you don't see. So what you see is some charge that just changes direction with the kink in it. And eventually, if you make the splitting small enough, roughly below the pion threshold, then you get long-lived, meaning on collider scales, so that it's basically collider stable, and you look for some chargino track through your detector, and then outside the detector at some point, it will decay. So these searches are basically looking for tracks. Okay, so let's look at the LEP searches. So the LEP combinations, they divided their searches into two main categories. The first is basically what we'll call the bulk region. So this is at large M0, meaning that the scalars are all decoupled. And here is our plot. So this is the charge enum mass. This is the neutral enum mass. Here is the line where the mass splitting is very small. So this is the compression line. Their other search category covers this in detail. So let's not talk about this for now. Their search is based on roughly 200 inverse picobarn per experiment, which is about a third of the total data set, so not the entire one. And their quota limit from here is that this is where they get the 103.5 GeV number from. So you'll notice here that actually, so the number, if we remember what we kept in mind for the cross sections of Higgs-enos and charge-enos, Higgs-enos and Wienos, it was sort of in the 2-3 picobarn ballpark range. Here, sort of, a lot of the region is actually right at 2 here. So for example, there's large regions here which are sort of bounded at 2 picobarn levels. So these are sort of order one exclusions. They're not excluded by huge orders of magnitude, but they're sort of just barely excluded. So what this tells you actually is including the, if you remember the threshold, so the mass effects that we talked about here, means that at this region here, you had a reduction because here you're getting close to the center of mass energy, half of that. So here you have a reduction below the 3 picobarn from Higgs-enos. So when you're talking about Higgs-enos, the cross section is already reduced to half of that, so 1.5, and even lower as you get closer to here. So actually, this region is right here is still allowed. So when you do a proper accounting for the cross section for charged particles, you get that the bound should be actually 88 GeV in this region here, and then of course up to here, since the bound is much stronger, it does actually sit up at 103 GeV, 103.5 GeV. So the first takeaway from this plot is that, depending on exactly where your model is sitting, your limit can actually be as low as 88 GeV already without doing anything else.
So you're saying I made an error the way they analyzed it, or is just that there's too little information in the total bound that they're quoting?
Yeah, the number that they give us, the number on the website, that 103.5, isn't correct for the entire space. It's only correct up here. So they have to be more specific. Either they have to give it over the full region, or if they want to quote like the absolute bound, ignoring all of this, then they should have said 88.
They didn't marginalize over that whole region when they were they didn't do a Bayesian thing when they said something.
No. Ideally, you'd want to get a full region plot because one number doesn't capture it. But if you're going to give one number that should capture it, I would prefer them give you the lower number.
The crappiest number, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I have a very simple-minded question.
Yeah.
We believe that no one has seen supersymmetric particles, LHC. So what is it that you're implying here? You're talking about charge-enos, supersymmetric particles. Are you claiming we haven't seen them at this energy?
Yeah, so I'm saying that here, this region is not excluded, and I'm going to show you actually, so I'll spoil it and tell you that the LHC does cover this region here. So this region is excluded by LHC searches, but there are regions up here which are not excluded by LHC searches. So there are open spots for less than 100 GeV charged particles. They may not be charge-enos, they might just be something else. I'm not committing to the supersymmetry because the only part I'm using from them is that they're produced basically with an S-channel photon, but I'm not committing to any part of the supersymmetric spectrum other than
the
that.
The neutralino, the gluino, they're way up at 1.3 TeV now.
Yeah.
They haven't been seen.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you expect to see these particles?
So for neutralinos, they can be a lot lighter because there's no strong production. So if your gluinos are out of the spectrum, then the limits from LHC directly on neutralinos and charge-enos is actually quite low. Like it's like order 100 GeV, depending on whether they're Wienos or Higgs-enos or the fraction.
So we need a new LEP.
It would be nice to have a new LEP. I would like that.
No longer exists. So how do we ever, when do we decide whether this stuff exists or not?
Well, you'd have to have observations. We're just talking about limits for now, so you need some type of positive observation there.
That's in the distance.
Yeah, we need a new collider to look through events there. That's right.
So when you say that the thing you're using is more robust, at one point you talked about there being a W. One of the ways you look for a branch ratio is you look at it. So is the assumption that it has to be a W, or if I had a singlet, a standard model singlet with these?
So I'm going to talk about the standard model singlet in a couple slides. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a good question. So before I get to there, let me just say that this is the archaeology part, is one has to be slightly careful because the combinations actually aren't, since they're not using the full data set, sometimes including newer results from just a single experiment gives you stronger limits. which is slightly weird to have to go back and do. So there's a multi-lepton search from Opal, which uses essentially their full data set. So they just look for two hard leptons and missing energy. Their limit, so this number here, it looks smaller, 0.2, but that's because it's on the limit of cross-section times branching ratio squared. So this will basically knock it down by an order of magnitude. So this is sort of 2-1, sort of in a similar ballpark to the last slide. And this is slimmer, so ADLOW is a combination LF, Delphi, L3, Opal. This is stronger than that combination in much of parameter space, just how it works out. So we can combine them here. So what this plot shows is the strongest limit over parameter space. So for this part of the parameter space, Opal, that search I just mentioned, has the strongest limit. But then they only go down to 50, so below 50, the combination obviously has the strongest limit. The combination also sneaks out a little bit to be better here. And then this region that I said was open from just the combination, it's closed, most of it's closed by Opal. So this closes up to basically 96 GeV. So this is still lower than 103, but it's much, much smaller. So there's some small window here. And again, I'll point this out many times, but this is sort of order one coverage, meaning that as things shift around, maybe by adding singlets or whatever, then the coverage can weaken substantially. The other category from LEP is the compressed region. So here now I'm zooming in to this line, which I just excluded here so I didn't have to talk about it. So I'm talking about it here, where now this axis is the splitting. So this is the charge state minus the neutral state mass. This is the charge state mass still. Here, the combination uses basically the full data set, and then they conclude that the limit is 92.4 GeV. So here is the various cross-sections they exclude. So they have ranges all the way from 10, so this is quite weak, 10 picobarn, down to sub picobarn. And the different regions sort of correspond to the different searches that they're combining. So here, these are the stable searches where they just look for stable tracks. So these are very strong. Now you get weaker because these are sort of the ISR regions where you have to look for something recoiling off of a hard photon. And then this is sort of getting back into the prompt region where you have strong limits again. And sort of the color contours here correspond to here, where now you can see that when you have stable stuff, the limits are basically as strong as they could be. When you have prompt stuff, the limits are as strong as they could be. But now in this in-between region where you're basing, where you're having to rely on ISR, this reduces down to 92.4 GeV. And then here in this case, they quote the weakest limit they have. So this is sort of the way that you would think they would quote it. That in some regions is 103, but sort of the weakest region you have is 92.4 if you choose the right mass splitting. And again, there's other searches that we should be considering. So Opal has a single photon search where they use, they look for basically a single photon and veto off two photons. And then Opal has a heavy stable charge particle search where they look for detector stable particles. So those can also be added into the bound. And now we do the same thing that we did before, adding all the various searches together and showing which ones are the strongest. So this is the Opal heavy stable, this is the Opal heavy stable charge particle search. This basically has the same shape as that last plot here. But now we sort of know the individual components so that as we change things, we'll know how they shift around. Here is this displaced. This is the ISR search, as I mentioned. This is the additional ISR search, which was done by just Opal. And then this is the combination from prompt searches. This is this this is a single result from Opal on multi-lepton searches. And then this is a piece from the combination here. So here, this is consistent. We find the same thing as their results, that the limit is basically 92 GeV, which is what they say. And again, this is order one coverage over this space. Okay, so as I mentioned, the parts are only excluded by a little bit. It's not obvious from the other plot because I just colored the contours, but here is how you can see it. So now I'm fixing a line. So I'm going to fix along basically a line right here. So I'm fixing the splitting. And now what I'm showing is the cross sections that's excluded by the various colored things I put on that plot. So the combination, the ADLOW combination, the red, is this is where the exclusion sits. So it sits at 2. At some regions, it gets stronger. At some region, it's weaker, and so on. And then the blue is the Opal result. So blue is stronger here, and then it's weaker over here. This dashed line is the cross-section for just a charge doublet, for Higgs xeno, for example. Here you see that it's excluded, and then around 90 GeV, which was where we said, then it becomes allowed because it's sitting below both of these colored lines. When it sits below both the colored lines, that's when it's allowed. So again, as we mentioned at the start, sort of the intuition was that varying electric charges gives more positive contributions. So this is the Higgsino we know is higher, and as you go to higher and higher multiplets, it would just go higher and higher. So you say this bound looks robust. On the other hand, if you couple to other particles, they can give negative contributions. So as you mentioned, if you couple to a scalar, for example, you can give a negative contribution here. In particular, an electron's neutrino in the energy channel can give you a negative contribution. So I'm going to show you now how negative you can get, and how much lower this can get, and exactly where this puts the bounds once you start taking this into account. So let's start off with a simplified model, so we don't have to worry about the entire supersymmetric spectrum. So here, let me start with a fermion doublet called F. So this is basically like a Higgsino. And then I'm just adding a scalar single S. So here, there's some mass terms. And then there's a coupling here between the, so this is the electron doublet, so electron neutrino. This is this new fermion I have, and this is this new scalar I have. So here, F will have electron number, which is different than the Chargino case. And then now we can ask about, so there's a charge state in F, and there's a neutral state in F. We can ask what the mass splitting will be. There's this well-known mass splitting from infrared effects. So the one-loop effect gives you this splitting, which goes like the weak coupling times the number given by the quantum numbers, and then the Z mass and the W mass. So you can sort of see that these are going to be order one. This is going to be order one. So this is basically, you know, 1/100th, and this is the mass of the Z. So this contribution basically always is on the order of 100 MeV. So it's quite small. So because we want to be able to look over that plane, we want to have some larger mass splittings. So you get larger mass splittings, you can consider, for example, the Weinberg operator, which will couple to the Higgses, and this will give you a larger splitting, basically determined by this coefficient here. So this will give you a contribution to the the neutral state, but not to the charge state. Okay, and now this is what your production looks like. So unlike before, you now have this state, this contribution, which we always already had. But now this singlet gives you a new diagram, which is a T-channel contribution like this. If you look at some part of the amplitude, they'll give you a photon contribution, the Z contribution, and then there's this T-channel contribution. So this is this coupling between, this is this coupling kappa that was sitting here, and this is some T contribution here. So this actually cancels off because T will have the negative sign here compared to S. But you can see that this won't be a full cancellation because we're canceling between T and S here. So it's going to be a partial cancellation, but it'll be some cancellation. And this will reduce the cross sections. I'll show you by how much, but by order one is a function of the mass of this new singlet that I'm adding in, and then the coupling strength between the singlet and the standard model particles. Okay, so this is how much it varies it by. So now I'm fixing the mass of the singlet, and I'm varying the coupling strength. So as I start from zero, it starts at three, then it starts to reduce, and eventually if I make the coupling too big, it starts to dominate the production, and when it dominates the production, it just starts to grow very quickly. But you can see here, it reaches the minimum at about 0.5, definitely less than one picobarn. Here, now I'm fixing the coupling strength, so the coupling strength I'm fixing at 0.5, and now I'm varying the mass of the singlet. Here you sort of see this is kind of a wide range, so this is sort of sitting below two, for quite a wide range of scalar masses. So it doesn't matter that the scalar mass is so close to the charge mass, it can roughly be wherever, and you still get a sizable cancellation here. In the two-dimensional contour, here you just see contours where the baseline was 3 picobarn. Again, as you expect at higher kappa, it starts to increase, but then there's regions here, fairly sizable regions, where for a range of scalar masses, you get quite large cancellations. So for example, the reduction at sort of one of the most optimal points would be 81 GeV of 0.5 coupling. And there you get a reduction already by three times. Okay. So in addition to changing the cross section, the other thing, as was mentioned, is that a scalar will change your branching ratios. So in particular here, this is the ratio we already had. This is the off-shell W. So this will give you some 3 by decay to leptons and to quarks. This is the 2 by decay to pion. And then now that you have a scalar, this mediates in another 3 by decay, where this ends up being the same final state as this one here, but the matching is slightly different. So here you have the charge state, the neutrino, and then the electron here. So what this does is here, this enhances the branching ratio because this particle only couples to electrons, it enhances the branching ratio to electrons. So this is the branching ratio plot that I showed before. Here the colors are slightly different, but here you can see that before where the leptons are sitting here at sort of the 11% range, the other leptons, so the muons and the taus get reduced here, but the electron gets enhanced pretty substantially. And then the quarks also get reduced a little bit. Then again, the electron starts to grow. Then once the pion, once we have a 2 by k to pions, the pion takes over again. And then in the sort of the low region, it sort of looks similar again, where the pions dominate. And then once you can't go to pions, then you have to go to electrons, and the electrons will dominate again. But you sort of have a region of enhanced electron branching ratio for a while. And then correspondingly, since you're adding a new contribution, it makes the width bigger, which makes the lifetime smaller. So this is the coupling strength. Coupling strength starts at zero. For some choice of parameters, I started at a decay length of about 50 meters. And as I start to vary this up, say up to 0.5, you get down to 20 meters. And if I make it high enough, then you get down to sort of 5 meters. So this is changing the decay length, which will change which searches are effective where. Okay, so this is back to this one-dimensional plot I showed, where again, these limits, this is the basic cross-section here. And if you're below both lines, then you're allowed. So here you see now that so the benchmark value that I'll use for the rest of the talk is a coupling strength of 0.5 and a scalar mass of 110 GeV. And at this point here, you see that you get reduced down to here. And so you can see that regions here are basically sitting below both curves. So before where you ruled out at 90, now you're basically sitting all the way down almost at 70. Basically, it's around 74 is now opened up, which is actually substantially lower than what you would have said that the let bounds were. So this is pretty interesting. This opens up quite a bit more space. And we can ask, are there any other windows now? So basically, we can redo the analysis, looking through the full space, and ask which windows actually open up. So let's start with the bulk region. Here before, if you recall, we had just this tiny little sliver here. But now, because these are sort of weak bounds to begin with, as you start to cross or lower the cross-section by just a little bit, it opens up quite a bit of space here. So the window here grows. So now 78 GeV is basically possible from LEP alone. I'll spoil the surprise and say that once we consider LHC searches, this region will be ruled out. But just considering LEP alone, it's allowed. And then now moving into the compressed region. So the compressed region, I think you can see it. There's some dashed lines here, and then there's the solid color lines here. So the solid color lines retreat quite a bit. So now you have regions basically around 74 GeV that are possible as well. So quite a bit of space opens up in the compressed region. And these hatched regions basically, so some of the searches are phrased in a way that assumes the branching ratio between pions and electrons. And because the efficiencies to find pions and electrons are different, it changes for us. So we can't just use their efficiency straight up. So the hatch is basically our best guess at what the efficiencies would be. But we don't know for sure because they don't break it down into categories for us, we can't actually recast it properly. So you can sort of see the hatch sort of covers this region here. This will be ruled out by LHC, so in a sense it doesn't matter. But sort of the robust bounds, there's actually sort of, big gap still between above 75 or so when you take into account adding a singlet. Yeah.
What are the limits on the scalars?
For the scalars, the limits are weaker because the scalar cross section is lower. So 110 for a scalar singlet would be perfectly fine. But do you mean for example, sleptons? Do you mean sleptons, for example?
Yeah.
The sleptons also are weaker, so sleptons would be sort of in the 90 to 80, depending on which slepton it is. Yeah, the rule of thumb is usually that scalars, they have a lower cross section because there's fewer states, and then there's also a threshold piece that goes differently for scalars. So usually it's roughly 4 or 5 times lower cross section. So because all the cross sections are order one, you can see that they won't reach their asymptotic limit of 100, but they'll be lower 60, 70, 80, depending on which flavors you're looking for.
Which is the LHC limits on the scalar?
The LHC scale limits on scalars are also fairly weak. Good, okay. So now let's talk about the LHC limits because they can also close some of this region that we said was open. So the LHC typically doesn't show results below 100 GeV. As I've shown, they just cut it off, which is slightly unfortunate. But we can still recast some of the limits that go below there. So just to give you scale, the rates at LHC are typically picobarn. So here's a plot of, for example, WeeKnows. One advantage you get from LHC is that before you had to produce just charge state and then charge minus state. But here you get the advantage that you can make the charge state and a neutral state and charge the state and a neutral state just because you have a variety of initial states from the fact that you have a proton. So these add up so that you get sort of picobarn level. The other advantage that LHC has is that it can produce heavy particles. So for example, you'll produce Higgses at LHC and you won't produce these at LEP, which means that if Higgses decay to your particles, either to your charged particles or your neutral particles, they can rule out space from those couplings. And the LHC has substantially higher luminosity. So this helps in searches that are very distinct. So for example, like track searches, like heavy stable charged particle searches, where the background is low because the signature is so distinct, the higher luminosity helps a lot here. Okay, so let's talk about limits from invisible Higgs branching ratios. So going back to how we managed to split the fermions, so you split via this operator, which means that there's a coupling of the charge state that goes to Higgses, but not of the neutral state to the Higgses. So this goes like the coefficient of this operator, which scales directly like the splitting between this. This is ignoring the radiative splitting, which is going to be ordered MeV anyways. So this says that this coupling, if the splitting is large, this coupling is quite large. And this coupling being large will give you a substantial width from Higgses into these charge states. The current branching ratio that's limited from Higgs to invisible states is less than 1/4, which means that if this coupling is sizable at all, this will rule out basically that possibility. So if the neutral state is half of the Higgs mass, meaning that it's actually possible to have this decay, this is basically ruled out, which means you have to have this heavier than this so that the Higgs can't decay into this state here. So as you can see, this will close out the region where the neutral state is very light and the splitting is quite large, meaning that the neutral state is light and the charged state is heavy. That's exactly the region that we had that was open in the uncompressed region. So if you show it here, this basically just covers out that region here. Because here, the splitting is large, which means the coupling of the Higgs is large, but also the neutral state is light, which means it's very possible to go in that direction here. Okay, so the uncompressed window is basically closed, so that's good news if you're worried that we could have missed something there. Let's take a look at the other region. Okay, so remember that the compressed region basically had this window, this kind of corridor open around 200 MeV. And this is sort of in the range that's good for LHC searches. So 200 MeV sort of corresponds to centimeter, meter long decay lengths. And that's sort of where disappearing tracks is going to be a useful search. So the way that disappearing track search works is I look for a chargeino or some charged particle that goes some distance, and then it suddenly decays into a neutralino and then a pion. Here, because the splitting is small, the pion is basically, you don't see it. So what it looks like is charge track, and then suddenly it just disappears because it went into something neutral and something soft. So you look for partial tracks. So ATLAS actually is very helpful in this instance, and they provide a reconstruction efficiency as a function of distance that it decays into. And so what we can do is we can go ahead and Monte Carlo. We can compute as a function of the mass of the charged particle and the actual decay length. We can compute the efficiency as a result of reconstructing the disappearing track. And then we can also match the remaining event efficiency because they give you results over a scanning. So they scan a range of different lifetimes. So we can use this to compute this efficiency. And then we match to what they say they limit on the number of events. So this enables us to basically recast their search for our simplified model. And when you do that, you find limits that sit sort of in this region here, which will basically cover this corridor here. So this region, so this is kappa. So there's different kappa values. Because the kappa values change the overall width, they change the correspondence between mass splitting and the overall width a little bit, which is why these lines move up and down a little bit. But roughly, they cover this region here. So it's only weakly dependent on kappa. And then you can also ask, in addition to disappearing track searches, you also have the stable searches, the heavy stable charged particle searches. But those will basically cover the same region as LEP because the detectors are the same size, which roughly determines where the band will be for that. Okay, and then finally from LHC, monojet searches are also useful. So here you just pair produce the charged particle and then you have some ISR jet off of it. So you look for high PT jet, large missing energy. The search from CMS uses basically the full data set. Their bins start and met sort of high at 250 GeV. And then this is useful for prompt decays with high rates, meaning that high rates come from lower masses, so they'll come from lower mass chargeinos. And then prompt decays, meaning that the splitting has to be larger. As the splitting gets smaller, then monojet won't be able to pick it up anymore. Okay, so let's put these all together into the compressed region. So here again, this is mass splitting. This is the charged mass. So the gray region is what LEP already excluded on these previous plots. This green is this disappearing track search that we showed on the last page. So this actually covers this region here that was sort of iffy before. And then the monojet covers the region where it's sufficiently large gap that it's prompt-ish, and then that the rate is high enough that you have a low low mass from the high rate here. So this cuts out sort of a region here, but it doesn't actually it doesn't quite get into this region here. So basically, as far as current results are open, you can basically have light charged particles as light as 74 GeV if you wanted to, provided that you add a scalar singlet into the spectrum, which is quite innocuous. So that's the statement. So if you want to revise the LEP limits, so you can actually go substantially below the 96, 94 that we were talking about, all the way down to 74. But you need to be a little bit compressed. The other thing to note is you can ask how far the LHC results will be in the future. So if you consider the high luminosity, so 3 inverse Atabarn, then this is sort of a preliminary projection. We need to look at this slightly more carefully. But it seems promising that it could sort of close most of this region here, but sort of unclear still to us. We need to look at this more carefully. OK, so let me conclude just by reviewing the different scenarios. So the first scenario is if you just take into account directly the LEP limits themselves, then really the weakest part in uncompressed space would be 88 GeV here, just from this window here. Sorry, 92 GeV from this window here. And then in the compressed case, you know, a little bit higher at 92 GeV. But taking into account the fact that you can add a singlet in lowers the bounds already, so it makes them less robust. So here you see that there's substantial gaps here, which will be covered. And then here, but these gaps survive LHC. Meaning that really when you take into account, so this is sort of an accounting of the current situation, is that charged particles below 100 GeV for uncompressed are basically excluded, which is what LEP said, but sort of not for the reasons they said. And then now in the compressed regions, there's actually still gaps that are available open right now. So charginos as light as 74 GeV are possible. And yep, that's everything I had to say. So then you can reduce the cross-section even more. The danger is if you add too many, you start to run into precision electroweak constraints. So for example, even like adding more scalars is roughly equivalent to increasing kappa by more, the coupling. And eventually when you get a kappa of like roughly 2-ish, maybe 1.5, then you start to run into electroweak constraints. So there's a limit to how far you can go, but you could do a little bit better.
So here's slide 23, I think it was. This is the one where you're looking at the, you're comparing the one with the pion and the,
yeah.
So, in the regime where the pion was important, when you were describing it in the plot on the right, you said that the red curve went up because the pion starts to. That's going up because of the, you're looking at the pion channel there. Is that right?
This one's going up because of this extra piece here, and then the pion starts to increase because then the pion becomes two body. So before it's just like two quarks basically, and then it switches to pion, which is two body. It also has a different dependence because you have the f pi goes into the amplitude.
Oh, okay, no,
so the power is different. Yeah.
This indicates it's very hard to kill supersymmetry.
Yeah.
There's always something, some pocket left that you can't get hold of.
Yeah. It's less obvious that there are light pockets available. I think this is sort of not as obvious.
Is to become unlikely in the end because of the getting up to 2 TeV and the bounds of neutralinos and blah blah. So it becomes unlikely that something is sitting down there at the electroweak scale, but that's a matter of opinion.
That's right, yeah. So you can always push it higher. But I think it's less obvious that the light stuff would remain. And in fact, so I think we have Suzy points that survive where you have to make the chargino more Wien-like, so it couples to electrons neutrino. But these ones, you don't have any space to play with the couplings, because this one I played with that coupling. With electrons neutrino, I can't play with that coupling, really. I just have a mixing to play with. So that case could be ruled out in the future.
So the IL, the International Linear Collider, has been reduced to 250 GeV as of a few days ago. What does that do for this? ILC has been reduced in energy because of money.
Yeah.
So if we have that machine, what could you say about this
So for these scenarios, the energy doesn't really matter because these are all easily produced by ILC. It's more important the luminosity that would matter here. So here, in a sense, actually circular would be slightly better because if you have more luminosity, the ILC would have slightly less luminosity for light charged particles. But it should, if as long as it's looking for it, should have no problem ruling out this type of light holes left behind.
Can we rule out supersymmetry in our lifetimes?
On the light end.
Maybe his lifetime.
Depends how long I live.